Jimmy Jones.
The next case on our calendar is 98-2358, Philip McMullen versus Ohio State University Hospital.
May I please report, Chief Justice Lawyer. On behalf of my partners, John Monson County and Dale Dalmanius, and our privilege to represent the family of George McMullen since 1992. As a young lawyer, many, many years ago in 1966, I watched my first argument before the Supreme Court. At that time, I thought to myself what a remarkable event in the life cycle of an attorney to be able to appear before the Supreme Court to argue a case. And while I still feel that that honor is as great as it is, it's tempered by the wisdom and knowledge that in some way, as an advocate, I have failed to make clear that which has always been clear to me, in representing the interests of the wisdom has taught me that in this particular case, the decision rendered by the trial court in the first issue on the matter of the liability was correct. It was correct from the standpoint that the judge below, Honorable Judge Bettis, the Court of Claims found that George McMullen died on October 21st, 1990. And in his opinion, page 11 of that decision, he noted that as a result of the conduct and the negligence of the nurses and resident anesthesiologists who undertook the care of this particular patient during the morning hours of October 14, 1990. As a result of an unplanned extubation and a failure to reintubate an appropriate amount of time, George McMullen's oxygen saturation levels plummeted to 29%.
When Judge Bettis decided this case, did he have the benefit or had Roberts been decided? Would it have made a difference had Roberts been in existence to Judge Bettis' decision?
Your Honor, before the liability issue of that case began, I filed with the court a brief. And I importuned the court at that time. This case was a very simple matter. And I would postulate to the court that if the case of Cooper versus Sisters of Charity were taken into consideration at that point in time, and we were to postulate that a sudden change in facts occurred in that case, that instead of the little Cooper boy being sent home by the emergency room physicians at Sisters of Charity Hospital, they retained him that morning. And the doctor, because the child had a headache, wrote an order to administer 5/10 of a milligram morphine to control the headache of this little 11-year-old child. A nurse misread that order and administered 50 milligrams of morphine to that child. And within 20 seconds, the child's heart stopped beating. Would there ever have been a Cooper versus Sisters of Charity case? I don't believe so.
Is the answer to
the answer is that we know what caused the death of the child. Even though this child probably had no chance of surviving, there was an act that brought about the death prior to the time that child would have died.
Does that make the answer to my question no?
The answer to your question is the Roberts had not been decided at the time.
Right, but if it had have been, would it even have made any difference to his decision?
It should not have made any difference. And that's why
that's my question.
I importuned the court that this case was simple on the facts, in that this woman was alive. She was a living, sentient being in the morning hours of October 14, 1990. She had been intubated because of fluid overload in her lungs. It was brought about by the administration of an excessive amount of fluids. She had been status post bone marrow transplant for myelogenous leukemia, and she was in total remission. The records are very clear in this case that when the autopsy was done on Georgia McMullen, it was found that she had massive necrosis and damage to her heart, to her brain, to her liver, to her kidneys, to her pancreas. As a matter of fact, the oxygen deprivation had been so great that her adrenal glands had liquefied.
I thought she had those conditions. There was testimony she had those conditions. Her liver was not functional. Her kidneys were starting to shut down. Her body was essentially...
No, that's not, Your Honor.
That's not the testimony?
With all due respect, some people may want those to be the facts, but the facts of the case were that she had marginally elevated creatinine levels, which showed that the kidneys were not shutting down, but the sensitivities needed attention. And she had marginally elevated bilirubin and SGOT and SGPT, which are liver function studies, which show that the liver was interacting as part of the process of whatever was going on with her at the time. But you must understand that the doctors did not arrive at any diagnosis. And when the autopsy was done, there was no leukemia found to be present. There was no graft versus host disease, which is, in other words, the rejection by the human body of the new bone marrow that had been transplanted into her so that she could produce red blood cells so that her life could be sustained. But the fact of the matter is that none of those things are really relevant, because what brought about her death and what Judge Bettis found to have brought about her death was that an oxygen saturation level of 29% is inconsistent with life. That's the judge's statement. And indeed, I will tell you that anybody or anything in this room would not be standing with an oxygen saturation level of 29%. The only thing to be standing is this podium, the bench where the honorable justices are seated, the chairs and tables in this room. Everything else would be down.
So whether she had leukemia or not, the leukemia didn't lead to her death.
No. Leukemia did not lead to her death. And you know, I will hearken to this, that my education many years ago, the priest of Notre Dame exposed me to a course in logic. At that time, I was told that Aristotle was the father of logic. And I thought to myself, well, perhaps someday I might meet Aristotle and I might speak to him concerning the decision of the Court of Appeals. And I might read to him and see what he thought about the statement. The statement is, similarly, University Hospital is correct that Dr. Crawford's testimony was sufficient to establish that University Hospital's negligence did not cause the scene's death, as she had no chance of surviving prior to the negligence. Now, if I were to give Aristotle that syllogism and ask him the truth of that statement, he would say to me, "And Gerald, are you telling me that because someone had no chance of surviving, that no one is capable of bringing about the death of that person who had no chance of surviving?" I would assume that perhaps Dr. Kevorkian's lawyers would like to have that decision in front of them, since if Dr. Kevorkian could administer a lethal injection to someone who was already dying, he could not possibly.
Well, you wouldn't give that syllogism or logic to Aristotle, would you? Because the facts in this case don't indicate, do they, that leukemia was the cause of death, or that she would have died in the hospital of leukemia.
Well, you know,
the premises.
I have never understood the wisdom of making a statement that she would not have lived to leave the hospital. I've had clients who lived in hospitals for years, so I don't know what that time frame means. That there's no clock on how long you are in the hospital. That statement really has no significance to me.
What was she in the hospital for?
Well, we're going to start with the assumption, Your Honor, and you're correct, that people generally are in hospitals because they're sick. And George McMullen was sick. Why George McMullen was sick, the doctors really didn't know. They were treating her with a battery of antibiotics because she continued to raise fevers and high temperatures. She would spike to 104 and then she would drop to normal. She would be normal for 3 or 4 days and then her temperature would go up again. But they were not able to pathologically diagnose graft versus host disease or really define any other organism subsequently. Later on in her care, they identified some bacteria that they were working with the antibiotics. But in my questioning of one of the expert witnesses in this case, and it's relevant here to take some of these factors into consideration, and that the court, when it made its pronouncement, and it should say the Court of Appeals, it said that there was no evidence here to support the judge's finding of 25%. I don't want to argue against myself from the standpoint of what we believe to be a very simple case on its merit. But in this particular situation, the Court of Appeals completely disregarded the testimony of Dr. Kaur, which said that there was a less than 50% chance of survival. The testimony of Dr. Blakely, who said there was a 50-50 chance of survival. Those depositions were filed and are part of the record. And of course, the testimony of our witness.
I gathered that the Court of Appeals viewpoint was that you can't take an average.
that there has to be testimony about 25% as opposed to averaging the experts. That was how I assessed their viewpoint there.
I've practiced law for 33 years and tried many cases, and I have questions, and I laid in bed one night and thought about it. I said, if this case had been tried to a jury, and a jury could render this verdict, other than the primary argument that we're making, that this is not a Roberts case, if someone were to buy the end of the argument that it is a Roberts case, would someone reverse this case on the basis of this against the manifest weight of the evidence, or is there some evidence in the record on which a jury could find? Of course there is. Less than 50% is 25%.
Yeah. It is an averaging sort of issue. Can a jury do that or a trial judge? May I move you to the why this isn't a Roberts case issue?
Why it is not?
Right. And I want to ask you the viewpoint that this is not a Roberts case because there was no testimony we know there was testimony that this patient, some experts said she had no chance of surviving, some said, but do you not agree that if the patient cannot, or the family cannot show that the patient had, but for the extubation issue, but for that, she probably would have survived. That would be the burden of the plaintiff in a wrongful death. And that has been interpreted to be more than 50%. Right. And was there, it didn't seem to me there was any evidence that there was a more than 50% chance that this patient would have survived but for the extubation issue.
My life's experiences tells me that none of us are going to survive. So really that can't be a determinative issue. The issue is what brought about the death.
The test I'm speaking about, counsel, is from the Cooper's case, isn't it? The sister's, the case.
The 50% chance to survive.
Indeed.
That is
the test, isn't it? Except, and this court said, but we're going to compensate for the loss of chance, even if it is less than 50%, we'll compensate for that. In our Roberts case, we said that should be the law.
That's why I am.
But you say this isn't a Roberts.
It is not.
And why not?
It is not for the reason, for the example that I gave you about Cooper.
You don't buy Cooper.
No, Cooper stood for what it stood for. That was the law. We all live by that. But even in Cooper, if I could show the cause of death, I didn't have to show that Timmy had a 50% chance of survivability. If I could show that an act of an individual brought about the death of Timmy Cooper, there would have been a Cooper's case. Because if the nurse misread the order and administered morphine that killed Timmy Cooper, then there's no Sisters of Charity case. I'm not required to meet a burden of 50% because I know that act brought about the death. Everyone is responsible for their acts in our society. If your act causes injury, harm, or death to an individual, you are responsible for that. It makes no difference whether or not that person might have died. I'm going to die. I know I am. My partner's going to die. We're all going to die. But if somebody kills me prematurely...
You're using your time here. Isn't your argument simply that loss of chance applies where you can't determine whether the pre-existing condition a person has caused the death or whether some aggravating circumstance, malpractice, caused the death, and so we have this loss of chance doctrine. Your argument, I think, is what Judge Bryant in her dissent argues, is that if you can clearly identify the direct cause of death, the intubation here, the delay in getting the tube back down her throat, that caused her death, that you don't need to look to the loss of... Isn't that your argument?
The Chief Justice has stated it better than I could. That is my argument. At this point, I'd like to turn...
Before you leave, I'd really like to get to the allocation issue, and if we can do it just shortly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cicciotti.
I'll do that.
Just want to know, wrongful death, the proceeds from wrongful death never go through the estate unless there's a pain and suffering, a survivorship action.
Survivorship goes through and you get taxed on it.
Yeah, I understand. And we used to always file the first cause of action, the second cause of action. The amount from wrongful death to the beneficiaries does not go through the estate.
Right.
Why then do you have to get permission of a probate court to allocate and distribute?
Because the legislature said to. Statutes just say, in fact, it's a shall. It's 2125.03 says the probate court shall distribute the money this year, so that's why. And I think the reasoning is like this. You have to go to the probate court to be appointed. And then I think what happens is when that award is made, no matter how it is, settlement, judgment, whatever it is from whatever court, you have to go back there, and then the court determines based upon the factors that it has. The law's all set up. It's not, you don't have to make any guesses about it. Then that court determines the beneficiaries. And those are the questions that the probate court is most permitted to do. They're the ones that have all the expertise. They're ruling on the heirs and who gets what all the time. So that's why I think the legislature said you go back to the probate court.
But almost, maybe it's also because it's inextricably, in many cases, intertwined with the probate of the estate of the decedent.
If you have an asset going on, it does. You know, if there's an asset that you have that's a probate asset other than a wrongful death, then you have to do the full administration. But on many times, you set up the executor, the administrator, for purposes of bringing the wrongful death to the statute that has you. And then once you get the award by way of settlement or judgment, then it gets distributed by the probate court. And that court alone has exclusive jurisdiction. The point that I want to really make to this court is as follows. You know, you're talking about the court of claim, you're talking about statutory creation. It says it's going to be governed by the rules and governed private people. Well, all us private people, when we have a wrongful death, we have to get appointed to the probate court where the decedent resided. And then we have to go back to the probate court. So as far as I'm concerned, that's where it belongs. The question is, always comes up, what do you do if it's settled? Well, if you look at this case, the court of claims said, here's awarded $250,000, and I agree with my partner, it should be $1 million. But the court said, and here are the set-offs. That information was sent to the probate court, the set-offs and the amount of the judgment. That's what was sent to the probate court. The probate court didn't make a decision about the set-offs. It took the decision made by the court of claims. All the probate court did was say, based upon the evidence that I have, and part of that evidence was that the decedent was going to support her mother. It was right there. And they, you know, they were close. This is not these aren't strangers. The court sometimes gets into that situation. And then said, here's how I'm going to distribute the money. Once that happened, then it was just a subtraction.
And if you look at it on the face, it looks like the probate court is doing funny stuff to get by the set-off.
Does look good.
I just heard something now that I didn't see and agree about evidence supporting the mother.
Sure, I can, very much. At the trial, this comes from Mrs. Capuccio, Mrs. Gibson, I think her name's Gibson. Yes. I think she actually testified about how often the mother, how often they visited. And then I happened to have been at the probate court, and that's where it was, she said that my daughter was going to take care of it. And told her to pay that. That's what happened. So, and then the next question is, well, why did we tell the defendant? Well, I looked at the code, and I couldn't find any reason to do that. And I think my job as a lawyer is to do what the law says I'm supposed to do. And then I thought about it, and I thought, well, I'm not giving them notice, but I am putting before the probate court exactly what they agreed to. This is an agreement binding between the parties about what the set-offs were. So I wasn't creating any numbers. I wasn't doing any guesswork. It's their numbers, and I gave that to the judge. His decision was based upon his independent evaluation. He made the decision himself. We made a recommendation like all lawyers do, and he made the decision himself, and that was a matter of subtraction.
Did Judge Bryant, in her dissent, on the allocation issue, find that the court of claims had the jurisdiction, or at the probate court? Because she just does it by assignment of error, and I haven't gone back and checked.
I don't think she focused on that so much as she did on the Roberts issue.
Yeah, well, she was clear on the Roberts issue.
No question about that. And I think what was going on is that what was happening is the Court of Appeals was trying to give jurisdiction to the court of claims that it doesn't have. I mean, it does not have the jurisdiction to make distribution, period. And the statute says, I mean, it's kind of, you know, we all learned in law school when it says shall, it means shall. It's not, you know,
most of the time.
Right.
Sometimes it means may.
Well, I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay.
I'm in law school.
And you used up your time a long time ago, Mr. Brown.
assessment and testimony of the mother, the daughter was reported to her. She then had a husband, a son, and a daughter. So I think we could take something from her, value-wise or other, and we allocate $245,000 to the mother and $1,000 to a father, a son, and a daughter.
From the 10th Circuit that would send this to the local probate court. After analyzing what occurred at that court, the Court of Appeals in the 10th District overruled Vandermeer. Judge Bowen, which is very important, concurred with Vandermeer in the first instance, and then concurred in that it was going to be overruled. The probate court have no jurisdiction over state money. The Court of Claims has original and exclusive jurisdiction over state liability. We have case after case after case. In this case, once the decision was published, we asked to be notified when there was going to be a hearing in the probate court. We were not notified, didn't attend, we didn't put on evidence on set off from that's according to Bachman. Once we were apprised of what happened at the probate court, then we went to the Fourth District Court of Appeals and were told we didn't have standing. Of the $250,000 that was considered damages by the Court of Claims under the Roberts Rule, $245,000 went to Georgia McMullen's mother. $5,000 went to Georgia McMullen's husband and her two children. Of that $245,000 that went to the mother, there were no settlements. Of the $5,000 that went to the father and to the two children, that was all set off. So in other words, there was $145,000 worth of set offs that were gone. Now, here's the difference. I can understand where Mr. Cincione, being the famous probate lawyer that he is.
Thank you.
The Court of Claims, in ruling on state liability, makes the determination. The 10th District finally figured it out. They made a determination on state liability. And the Court of Claims determined state liability will be $250,000. Once that determination is made, and the Court of Appeals laid it out for us, gave us a roadmap, they said, now, what we're going to do is comport with Chapter 23, and we're then going to send this to the local probate court for what we would call, I'm going to find the word, for distribution under the code. Court of Claims, to protect state coffers and protect state money, will make the determination of the amount of damages. The local court will then make the distribution, make the adjustments, up and down, whatever they want to do. At the same time, in the Court of Claims, is where this should be, we must have a hearing on, according to Bachman, on set-off, and to see whether we can match the sell-offs with what the Court of Claims has set out as what the damages are and how they're going to apply under this case. At the same time, we then want to match up as in Bachman. We have to have that hearing, and the hearing's got to be in the Court of Claims because that's where we're going to find out the answer from the judge on what damages apply to what. To answer your question, Your Honor.
Mr. Brown, I'd like you to move on to address the issue of why this is a loss of chance case. What evidence was presented by your expert showing that this woman would not have survived.
Let me start off by correcting one thing. This is the official decision of the Court of Claims on liability, which was the first case that was tried. We have liability that we had changed. Section 3 on page 11. The recent case of Roberts versus Ohio Primitive Medical Group has markedly changed the law in Ohio, overruling Cooper versus Sisters of Charity and declaring that Ohio state law now recognizes a claim for lost chance of survival. This court knew exactly what Roberts was. Roberts was decided before this decision came out.
That's why I want you to address that.
This is a Roberts case.
That's what I want.
This is a Roberts case. The court is the trier of fact in the Court of Claims. The court was confronted with this issue. Either determined that the plaintiff's experts were correct and that the issue, we are going back to standard negligence and proximate cause, or were we going to take the avenue of the Roberts case? Prior to October 14th, Georgia McMullen was very ill. She came to the hospital. She just went downhill from there. She suffered from a leukemic condition. She was on a ventilator, 100% oxygen, not being evolved in a normal fashion, but being pumped into her lungs. She had liver, kidney, and bowel dysfunction. She had sepsis. She was on, which is very unique, she was on 24-hour, one-to-one nursing care. Georgia McMullen was very young. And this judge had this opportunity to make a decision as to whether she had the probability of surviving. And he decided there was not the probability of surviving and went into the Roberts analysis, and that's what the judge did. One of our experts, Dr. Steele, said that she had less than a 20% chance of surviving. The other expert, Dr. Crawford, who has made a life of studying leukemia patients, Dr. Crawford said she had a zero chance of surviving. We had, on the other side, and this is not critical but truthful, we had a pathologist who doesn't do autopsies on leukemia patients, and we had an anesthesiologist. Both testified. One said could. So his testimony was limited. Could doesn't make it. That would be more probable than not. And the other one testified as an anesthesiologist. The court discounted her testimony, put it into the Roberts rule. That's what occurred in this case.
Do you believe,
is a Roberts case.
Do you believe, Mr. Brown, that the trial judge here concluded that the intubation was a direct cause of her death? Or he doesn't say that, but he says that after negligence by the people treating her, that her chance of survival decreased to zero. I guess that means she died.
Proximate cause was never mentioned in this case. The standard form of negligence and a lost chance are juxtaposed. What we're talking about here is a lost chance of survival. One that has never discussed proximate cause, did not discuss, did not also take any evidence whatsoever on life expectancy.
Did either of
them? This was a lost chance case. Proximate cause, read the decision. Never mentioned. You went from standard.
Well, no, but I think, in fairness, we have to, if we're going to write some more law after Roberts to give direction to everybody who needs direction, we need to not just take what Judge Bettis did, what he just said or didn't say. We need to write the law so that there's maybe more clear direction than we got from his opinion.
Well, I'm just trying to impress upon the court that this was a lost chance case. That opinion, if he was going to get it harmonized with standard negligence, he would have mentioned in the proximate cause of her death was, this is a lost chance case. There is no proximate cause. All the commentators in the states that have ruled on this, including Ohio, proximate cause is not part of the element of a lost chance case.
That's, I agree with you. That's why I'm wondering what his entry means.
I'm sorry.
Did either of those two doctors give a date when she was going to die?
No. I think that's up to God.
So the determination of her life was in doubt. They didn't know when she was going to die.
They have, from their education and experience, in
treating this fine.
But for this procedure, she could have been living.
They felt, both of the experts, highly qualified experts, one felt she had a 20% chance of survival, the other felt she had a zero.
But the procedure that was not done, or done in this case, was the procedure that killed her. The leukemia didn't kill her, or her condition didn't kill her.
That's incorrect, Your Honor. Dr. Baker, who did the autopsy, said she died of complications of each.
Not the procedure that was allegedly negligently done.
Dr. Baker, in examining the body, I think came up with that conclusion that she was so far gone that she died of complications of leukemia.
So the procedure made no difference?
I don't think it does.
Did it not? I mean, it had to be argued that it hastened her death. You wouldn't
that
have
would
25%.
Correct.
It had to have hastened.
That would be correct.
And that was the basis for the Roberts decision, was where there's a plaintiff with a pre-existing condition the patient was suffering from a condition at the time the malpractice occurred, and it hastens their death. But it would have to be. I mean, there's a lot of people who suffer from something and then have a wrongful death action, even in an auto accident. But it has to be that patient whose condition gives them less than a 50% probability of survival. That would have to be one of the conditions to trigger Roberts.
That is the essence of Roberts. A new cause of action where we have less than 50% chance of survival before. You couldn't get that question asked by an expert. You have to base on the standard negligence.
And it's all about causation and the probability of survival. But now that gets us to, I mean, assuming for a minute that this indeed is a Roberts case, the issue here is that no one testified that 25%, that the chance of survival or the loss of chance is 25%. It only comes from apparently an averaging of the varying percentages offered by experts.
One said highly probable, one said less than 20%, one said zero.
We know no one said 25.
That's probably why the Court of Appeals felt it's a manifest good. I want to say one more thing about Roberts.
But should it have to be? I mean, isn't that, I mean, the... Isn't that an unusual posture to take where a jury could assess, a trier of fact, in this case a judge, could assess an average, to take, you know, the something in between the percentages, the experts?
Trying to harmonize the experts' opinions. I never asked Judge Bettis what happened there, but I do want to mention one other thing that's very important. The commentators, the cases, to the left, they all say the same thing. The trier of fact makes this decision. Judge Betts is the trier of fact.
It always has to be supported by competent, credible evidence.
Obviously, there was reams of evidence concerning George McMullen's condition, and it was all bad.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Brown, I want to understand the procedure from your standpoint. The trial was bifurcated. Judge Bettis found liability. And you seem to say that you agree with that decision now, based on Roberts.
I agree with the Roberts decision. Okay. I don't agree with the percentage.
Now, wait. You agree with the liability under the Roberts decision?
Yes.
All right. Then you did the damage phase. And he awarded, as I recall, the $250,000.
Yes.
Did you appeal that?
Yes.
So you don't agree with the award of the damage and the amount?
No, sir.
So you disagree with that, and you disagree with the fact that he remanded to the probate court for allocation?
That's correct. The Court of Claims is the only court that can determine state liability.
So we're to the point of, if in fact you don't agree with the $250,000, that, and you do agree with liability, that you're arguing for some lesser figure, and you want us to set that?
I think it should be remanded back to the Court of Claims.
To set something less than 250?
I think they have to take it in accordance with the evidence, Your Honor.
Well, he did that, he thought.
Well, the Court of Appeals thought differently. I have one more subject that I would like to bring up before I give up my time. Is that lost chance of survival is a survivorship case by its very nature. It is not a wrongful death case. Professor Payne, who is the leading commentator, probably started this all early back in 1981. He said, most courts have misperceived the nature of the interest destroyed by failing to identify destroyed chance itself as a compensable loss. The chance itself is what is compensable, not the debt. The wrongful death statutes, whether it's in Delaware, which has ruled on this, Missouri, which has ruled on this, Texas, which has ruled on this, or Maryland, which has ruled on this, when confronted with the issue, have all said, this is not a wrongful death case. One reason is because wrongful death, whether it's our statute or the states I've mentioned, all mentioned cause the death. There's no evidence in this record, and the prior facts back it up, there's no evidence that caused the death.
You need to stop.
Case approved. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. DiCuccio, you've used your time. You may take 30 seconds.
Here we are. We'll just ask the court, and for 2 minutes, to walk with me for 1 moment. Does anyone on this bench, this honorable bench, feel that they can place their fingers over their nose, hand over their mouth, in class for 20 minutes or allow someone else to do that, and that not bring about their death ultimately? And the answer to that is no. If you are an officer for 20 minutes, which this lady was, you are going to have diffuse damage to your pancreas, your kidneys, your liver, your intestines, your lungs, your brain, and that's what Dr. Baker found. That was his testimony. With all due respects to our former Attorney General, Mr. Brown, I tried the case. I cross-examined Dr. Baker, and Dr. Baker did not deny that the report was in the record in which all those findings were made, and that they were the underlying cause of death, including diffuse aortic damage to her lungs brought about by
the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals reversed the judgment of Judge Bettis, the trial court.
That's right.
But they remanded it. For what purpose did they remand it?
Your Honor, I've read the decision 20 times, fine 20. I still don't understand the decision.
That's why I was asking Mr. Brown, where are we procedurally?
Because the Court of Appeals, even if they were to adopt Roberts, they also have taken into consideration Dr. Kufour's testimony that the woman had less than a 50% chance of survivability, and 25% is clearly less than 50%. Didn't take into consideration Dr. Blakely, who said 50-50.
But forgetting all that, the procedural aspect that I'm concerned about now, they reversed the case. It had to be reversed then on both the damages and the liability, because they reversed it and remanded it back. And what's left, it seemed to me, is Judge Bettis giving final judgment to the defendants.
Well, I suppose you could interpret that.
Except that's not what they say with regard to Roberts.
Okay,
so I'm not missing anything. It's confused.
No, I don't understand. And I appreciate the court's time.
Thank you. Thank you. Case is submitted. You may advise your opinion.
No.